RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
My guest today is the production designer Richard Hudson. In his 30-year career, he has been responsible for the design of over 130 productions spread over theatre, opera, dance, and musical theatre. The majority of his work has been in the world of opera, where the costumes are also another key element in his craft in bringing to life the myriad of worlds required for the genre, be they set in the past, present, or future. It was at a meeting with Jonathan Miller that gave him a unique opportunity to shine. As a relatively unknown designer, Miller entrusted Hudson to design an entire season at the Young Vic, the result of which earned him a Laurence Olivier Award in 1980 and placed him firmly on the map as an exceptional production designer. On starting out his career, he was warned by a wily old theatre director that he would never make any money. In 1997, Hudson designed the stage version of The Lion King. It became an instant success, and much to do with its complex and dramatic set. It is now playing in 56 countries, and all featuring Richard's stunning sets. To date, some 65 million people have seen it, and he is justifiably proud at the thought of introducing families, and in particular children, to the magical world of theatre. I spoke to him at his home in London's Clerkenwell, and we started our conversation musing on his ability to work on multiple productions at the same time.
I totted up the number of productions you've done over your 32-year career, which it may be wrong, but I've checked on the list. You say it's 130,
right?
Of which there are 61 operas, 11 ballets, 42 theatre pieces, 2 musical theatre, which I think is it would be Oklahoma. And of course, The Lion King, and
Into the Woods also.
Into the Woods, right? Yeah, okay, yeah. That, you know, on average, that's about 4 a year. I know sometimes you're doing more than that, but that is quite a pace. And I'm just interested to know how you keep all those balls in the air, because I as a graphic designer, I worked for English National Opera when Peter Jonas was there, and I created the identity. I was there a lot, and I could see the sheer amount of work that goes into the creation of a set and costumes, and it's pretty daunting. And so I'm thinking, if you've got 4 on the go, maybe in different countries, how do you keep it all together?
That's a very good question. I think I'm pretty organized. For every project I do, I have a notebook, which is also a kind of sketchbook, in which I sketch and make notes and write down things that the director has specified or come up with. And I also have a kind of reference file, which now come from Muji. And they're just everything that's anything to do with the show, or that is a colour I like, or a pattern or a texture or something, goes into that file. And that file has the name of the project on it. And I suppose the biggest bore is carrying all these files around with me. Of course, nowadays, some of it's on my iPad.
Yeah.
But I have those with me all the time, so that if anybody at any one point asks me a question about one of the projects, I can pretty quickly lay my hands on
it. So they
the
have
answer.
Their self-contained files that you,
yeah.
And notebooks and
yeah.
Scraps and all those things. So that's a good way to keep that together. And have you always worked like that?
Yes. And in fact, in my studio, I've got an enormously long shelf with all those files and all those notebooks.
Oh, that's
it is quite impressive. The other thing, of course, to remember is that the scale of the projects varies enormously.
Sure.
A play might be a two-hander, or I think the smallest project I've ever done was one costume for Catherine Hunter in a play called Kafka's Monkey at the Young Vic.
Right,
and
yes.
I think the biggest project I ever did was probably Kovantchina by Mussorgsky for the Paris Opera, and that had 700 costumes.
Well, looking at your catalogue of work, clearly you've designed some of the most esoteric and sublime pieces in opera and ballet and theatre, but there is, looking through, one anomaly. Maybe you disagree, but it's the most enduring and acclaimed piece you've done to date, and You've done 25 productions of it, and that's The Lion King, which, you know, I've not actually seen it, but I've had a look at lots of bits, and it's incredibly complex piece of work, and obviously thrills families all around the world. You know,
it's, apparently 65 million people have seen it.
Everyone I seem to talk to, you know, they've all been to see it and said how, you know, amazing the and realistic the scene is with the, I think it's the wildebeest.
Wildebeest
that come towards you and they're on a series of rollers and they appear to be getting closer. But that, how did that come about? Because you're really, I think you're really known as a opera and ballet,
yes,
I think.
It has. It was strange how it came about. I think Julie Taymor, the director, and the designer of the puppets and costumes, she was approached by Disney to make The Lion King, which was then a hugely successful children's movie. Mm. I think the most successful kids' movie ever.
Yeah.
She was asked to make it into a piece of theatre. And I know that she had seen a play I'd done on Broadway called La Bête. And also, not around about that time, a book about stage design came out, which had a chapter on me. And I think she'd seen that, and she'd seen images of my work.
What was your reaction when...
Well, the first thing I had to do was go out and rent the movie, because I'd never seen it. And then I had two reactions. First of all, I thought, this is impossible. I can't possibly do this on stage. But my second reaction was, I really, really want to do this, because it's set in Africa. And I was born and brought up in Africa.
You were born in Zimbabwe, yes. Yeah.
So Rhodesia, as it then was.
Yeah.
And I'd only ever done one African project, which was a play by David Lann called Desire, uh-huh, at the Almeida,
yes,
which was set in southern Rhodesia, as it was at the time of the Civil War. And I loved doing that. So the idea of an African project really excited me. And Disney actually didn't know that I was born in Africa.
And so Disney, obviously, because it was a Disney-backed production, which, I mean, they now do. I mean, they never used to do theatre productions at all. And obviously, yeah, with the success of this, they clearly see this as another area. I was listening to the radio the other day, and Derek Jacobi happened to be on and was interviewed by Mark Lawson. And he said to him, aren't you rather disappointed that you have not been involved in any of these big franchises like Harry Potter and all that? And he clearly was, and said, yes, I would love to have been, because, you know, that's the pension. And I'm thinking about this production, 25 productions, which you would clearly would have your set and you would supervise it and check. It goes on and on. It must be a fantastic sort of
pension.
Yeah.
Well,
great support for you to allow you maybe to do smaller things for very little money, yeah, that you really feel passionate about. And that's the terrific
thing
about
these. That's absolutely true.
Yes.
And in fact, upstairs in this house, in my bathroom, I've got a collection of little mini Mickey Mouses. And that's so that when each morning when I'm cleaning my teeth, I can remind myself of who paid for this house. But the great thing is that I never, ever expected to have any money. I remember when I was 18, 19, and made up my mind that I was going to be a stage designer and, mm-hmm, go to Wimbledon School of Art.
Mm-hmm.
I was sharing a flat with my brother in Hammersmith on the river. And at the top of the house, the very well-known playwright and director Peter Gill was living.
Mm-hmm.
And I bumped into Peter one day on the stairs, and he said, well, you know, what are you up to? And I said, I've decided to be a stage designer, and I'm going to Wimbledon School of Art. And he said, well, that's great, Richard, but there's just one thing you've got to realise, you'll never have any money. And it was true up to a point,
well,
until 15 years ago.
As you've touched on that, let's wind back to your early years. We've established, you were born in Zimbabwe in the 1950s. So how did that, tell me a little bit about that,
My father went to southern Rhodesia just before the war to join the colonial police. He was really sort of running away, I think, because his father wanted him to join the family firm of solicitors,
right,
which my father didn't want to do. Anyway, so he went to Africa for a time, had a ball, absolutely loved it. And then war was declared, and so he came back to England to join the Air Force. And during the war, he met my mother.
Right.
And they got married and had my elder brother. And then when war was over, he persuaded my mother to go with him back to Africa to sort of start a new life.
And so what are your memories as a...
I'm the youngest of my siblings. And
how many of you were there?
One brother, one sister.
Right.
So when I was little on the farm, they were at school.
They were away?
Yes, at boarding school.
In this country or?
In Rhodesia. And our farm was pretty remote. So I was brought up pretty much on my own. And I think that's one of the things that helped my creativity, I suppose, was that I had to make my own entertainment and imagination.
Yes.
Didn't have a television. My godfather, who was a carpenter, made me a puppet theatre, and that became an obsession. And then I was sent away to boarding school, which was, you know, ridiculous, sort of very much like a British public school, but in the middle of the bush.
Right.
And the one I went to was very unusual in those days in that it was multiracial.
Really?
But it also had fantastic facilities. We had an indoor theatre and an outdoor amphitheatre.
So is that where your sort of leanings towards theatre started?
Definitely.
Were you a creative child? I mean, you said already that...
Drawing all the time. Yeah, making things.
And so at that school, how did you sort of channel...
I think we used to do at least one, sometimes two plays a term. And I got involved in the acting. In fact, when I was 14, I played Shylock in The Merchant of Venice, and my best friend played Portia. I've got photographs of it. And I don't think I was really that good at acting, and I certainly found it incredibly difficult to learn my lines.
Yes.
And so I sort of got sidetracked and started helping paint the scenery and make the props and...
You were at that school until...
Until I was 18.
And then what happened? How did you transfer over to this country?
My brother was already here.
What did he do?
He's an interior designer.
Ah, okay.
And I knew I wanted to go to art school.
Yeah.
I thought I wanted to work in the theatre, but I wasn't quite made up my mind. I thought also possibly being a graphic artist.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I got to England and I discovered you could actually train to be a stage designer. And don't forget, at this time, I'd never seen a professional piece of theatre, let alone an opera or a ballet. It was all just amateur or at school.
So you applied to Wimbledon?
To Wimbledon.
And got in on a foundation first of all?
I did a foundation in Leeds, actually, at the Jacob Cramer College.
Right.
Because I had an aunt and uncle who lived in Harrogate. And my father was quite keen that I live with them for a while, which I did. And so that was my foundation course.
Right.
And then I came down to London and went to Wimbledon.
Because I think, if I remember correctly, that Wimbledon had a pretty good reputation, did it?
It did,
not
yeah.
For, I don't know whether Wimbledon still has a production design course
or
not.
Oh, it does, indeed,
still
a
does.
Really big one. And film design and
it's
costume design. And yes, in fact, one of my goddaughters is there studying at the moment.
So you started that as a three-year course, I take it. Was it?
Yes.
Three-year course. Yeah. And at the end of that...
During that, in the second year, we were tutored by a designer called Yolanda Sonnebend.
Who you worked with very early on,
yes,
didn't you?
Yes, and who coincidentally was also born in Rhodesia.
Ah, I see. Okay.
So we had this little sort of bond about Africa. And so when I left Wimbledon, she was one of my first employees, and I assisted her quite a bit. And then through her, I got to know a very eminent Greek designer called Nicholas Georgiadis, who'd lived in England for years. I think he came here in the 50s. And he designed mainly ballets for Rudolf Nureyev and Kenneth Macmillan. And I was fortunate enough to get a job assisting Nico for about 8 or 9 years. Which also involved an enormous amount of travelling, which for me, having been brought up in Africa and never been anywhere except Mozambique, it was thrilling, you know, for the first time to go to Europe and America and all these wonderful places.
So you were sort of a dedicated assistant to
yeah.
him?
And through Nico, met all sorts of incredible people.
Yeah.
I mean, apart from Nureyev and Kenneth Macmillan,
of course,
Lynn Seymour and all these wonderful dancers all over the world and choreographers.
So when did you break the umbilical cord?
I think about 8 years later. I left Wimbledon in 1976, and I think I worked for Nico for 8 or 9 years. And then I started being asked to do sort of student opera productions at the Royal College of Music and at Warwick. They had a student opera. They used to put on one a year. Plays at Brada.
Yeah.
And it was through those that I met various directors of my own age, choreographers. And so slowly my career started taking off. But there's there were directors like Graham Vick,
yes,
he gave me one of my first jobs. Well, I'm still working with him now, 35 years later.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the process, because I think anyone listening who not familiar with how the process works is always quite fascinating. So your approach normally, I take it, by the director or in some cases the producer,
yes,
of an upcoming
usually
opera.
my agent,
your
agent,
yes, of course,
and ask for my availability first,
yeah,
and then Judy my agent might ring me up and say, you've been offered this, are you interested? If it's somebody I've worked with a lot, then I'll be approached directly by them. Graham might ring up and,
yeah,
say, oh, I've been asked to do such and such, would you like to do it?
Then once your agent has checked out with you your interest and your availability is there, presumably, as with all creative minds, there's a coming together.
Yeah.
And as you say, it could well be someone you've worked with before, so you've got that shorthand. But if it's someone new, presumably there's a little bit of... Because I'm just wondering the effect that the director has in most of, in the movie world, and I'm assuming in the world of theatre as well, the buck stops with the director, and everyone surrounding in a collaborative process,
yeah,
works. All the threads go to the director. And I'm wondering what the relationship...
That's pretty much true in the theatre as well,
yeah,
I think. But then directors are very different.
Yeah.
Their approaches are very different. Some directors will come to me with a very firm idea of what they want to do, how they want a play or an opera or whatever set, and the direction it's going to take, and even sometimes the sort of shape of the set, the sort of dynamic of it. And there are other people I've worked with who sort of give me completely free rein.
Give me some examples of that, but it's interesting to know.
Just in the last few years,
yeah,
I've started working with a fantastic Russian choreographer called Alexei Ratmansky.
Mm-hmm.
He used to run the Bolshoi, and he's now a freelance choreographer, but a resident choreographer with the American Ballet Theatre,
right,
in New York. And he's, I guess, in his early 40s, so younger than me. He very much gives me a free rein. We discuss what period something's going to be set, whether,
yeah,
it's going to be contemporary or in the original period or whatever. It's mainly classical ballet. We've done a Nutcracker and a Romeo and Juliet and a Cock d'Or. But one of the most remarkable things about Alexei is that he will sometimes change the choreography to suit the design.
Really?
Which, wow, in my experience is unheard of. I mean, in the Nutcracker, for instance, the Spanish variation, when I was fitting the girls, they said, oh, we can't do the choreography in this. The train's too long. We're doing steps backwards and we'll trip on the,
yeah,
train.
Yeah.
And the mantillas are too high for, yeah, when we lift our arms and blah, blah, blah.
Of course.
So I said, well, take the costumes down to the rehearsal room. The next time you do that bit, put them on and see what Alexei says. And Alexei loved the costumes and just changed the choreography.
So that
and that's happened several times since.
And when you're given total freedom, do you find that more rewarding? Or
no, not really.
Because I know as a designer myself, designers are, in essence, problem solvers. Someone has a problem, you solve it creatively.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah,
how it works. And if someone, I know for me, if I have a client who says, do whatever you want, I then become the client, and then I have a nightmare because I think, oh, it's not good enough, There's nothing to measure again.
Yes.
And also,
I think one of the things I love most about what I do is the collaboration.
Yes.
Initially collaborating with a director or a choreographer, and then collaborating with all the other people, the costume makers,
yes,
the set painters, the props makers, the production managers, a sort of huge team of people.
I've always been very envious of the collaborative world where, regardless that there's a director, you're all pulling together to create this thing, and then on a given night, even though it can be adjusted to a certain extent, generally speaking, on the given night, that's it. You give birth to this thing, and collectively,
yeah,
you can all say, well, I was a bit of that. That's,
yeah,
that's mine.
And in my experience, the best productions are the ones where you can't remember who thought of what. And I'm I'm not averse to a costume maker, for instance, or a costume supervisor or something, making suggestions in a fitting, you know, saying, are you sure that's right, Richard? Don't you think it should be a little bit longer or something? I love all that.
Well,
you know, that discussion and...
I'm fascinated by the fact that production designers, particularly in theatre, more in theatre than in cinema, are also responsible for the costumes, which is a, you know, it really is a different discipline, isn't it? Really?
Totally different.
I mean, although the figures within the set are important, you know, and have their colour, whatever, it is a different discipline. And it means you have to have two very, very good creative strings to your bow. Do you find the because you have been involved with some productions where you've just done costumes, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, there's a Japanese director I work with, Yoshio Ida, and he's been working with a Dutch set designer for years. And we only met each other, I don't know, about maybe 6 or 7 years ago. But I've done quite a few productions with him where I just do the costumes. And I think I would only do that with Yoshi, actually.
Right.
Because I really do like doing both.
The whole thing.
I always have to design the set first, and I can't think about the costumes until the set is finished.
Okay.
I always feel it's like...
You could create the world.
Create the world, and then you populate it.
Let's go on. You've met up with the director. He's given you the, you know, whatever it is, if it's a play, the script, or if it's an opera, then you're familiar with it, or if it's a new opera, then you'll listen to it, and you'll have a chat with many operas, right? Many classic operas, you know, they're put in different time zones. Sometimes the costumes are in one time zone and the set is in another. You know, it's, you know, that's the great thing about theatre. You can fool around with it.
Yeah.
So once you're on a track, you go off, and how do you?
Initially, I do lots of research.
What sort of time? Let's get a time scale. So from the moment that you're approached, generally speaking, what's the time?
Opera or a ballet or a big musical, it would be about 2 years before the opening night.
2 years?
Yeah.
Right.
And usually my delivery date for all the designs is about a year before the opening night. So it's a big time scan.
Yes.
And I suppose back to your question about how you juggle all these projects in the air. You can, I think, because they're quite spread out. They're quite protracted.
So
you're not working solidly for a year on one thing.
Yeah.
It's doing a bit here and then a bit of something else and then going back to that one.
So you do the initial research thinking and then you work with your assistants and model makers.
One of the first things I do is collect images and colours and things like that to show the director. This is kind of what I'm thinking. Do you think I'm going in the right direction? And then I bring in my assistants and we make a 1 to 25 model box of the theatre with the proscenium arch and hanging, you know, flying bars and everything if it has those.
I've been to the model showings on many occasions and I've always found that very magical. You know, everyone gathered around, not knowing quite, you know, what they're going to be seeing. And the moment they see it, you can see their eyes lighting up. And they suddenly realise this is the little world that we're going to be in.
Yeah.
And how much do you get involved with the lighting as well? Because I know mostly the lighting and sound design is a separate entity, but we're getting a sense of lighting.
Lighting is
models
crucial.
Really, yes.
Yeah, not only in the models, I always try and light my models really carefully and then photograph them.
Yes.
So everybody has an idea of what I really want it to look like and the feel of the lighting.
Yeah.
But I also always have a lot of conversations with the lighting about colours, where the light's coming from.
In terms of the set design and lighting, is that your responsibility, even though there is a lighting designer? How much is it a collaborative thing?
It's just a collaboration.
So you can say, I want a hard light because it's important to get shadows, whatever, and they will...
And it's crucial.
Yeah.
I mean, lighting can ruin a set.
Yes.
Or it can make a not very good set look fabulous.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I go to the Almeida Theatre a lot, which is, as you know, a tiny theatre, but the number of occasions that little space has been transformed stunningly, really beautifully.
Yeah.
It's the magic of theatre in that little space. That's the place to go because it's intimate and you can see what a set designer can do and how the actors respond to those spaces. You know, it must have a lot. It must help them an enormous amount to be in the right space, just as being in the right clothes as well.
Yes.
I remember Anthony Powell, the costume designer, the film costume, telling me that how he insists whenever doing a period film, of which he's done a lot, that the actors must wear from bottom up everything in period, underwear, the whole bit, shoes, socks. And I thought about this and I thought, wow, that's amazing. And then I realized, of course, if you're going to inhabit a character, what better way than to actually dress exactly from whatever's against your flesh to the outside? It'll help enormously. Yes. And he said, absolutely, that's really important.
The number of times I've heard actors say, oh, yes, now I feel right. Yes. Now I've got these shoes on.
We'll continue our little journey on the production. So you've now shown the model to everyone, all present, and then from then on it's
taken
the
away by the production manager,
who's
in charge of the budget for a start. So he will first of all make sure that we can afford to do whatever I've designed, and if we can't, then it'll be sent back to me and I'll have to make changes or cuts. Or a sensible designer puts inbuilt cuts.
Right.
So you put one or two things in that you don't really want. So those will come out, and then we can perhaps afford what we really want.
Right.
And then it gets sort of split up, and the pieces that are going to be painted go to one department, and the bits that are going to the carpenters, or the metal workers, props makers.
And they're all key people because, you know, if you want a particular look and texture and all that, and you want it to look rough, I mean, they know exactly how to do that. You know.
So then my job is to talk to all of those people about what I really want. I suppose most of the theatres where I work have their own workshops. So if it's somewhere new, I have to get to know those people.
And I take it that you and your assistants will do all the technical drawings that are done.
Yes. Not the construction drawings.
No.
But the technical
But the
drawings,
main technical drawings, yeah. There is a rather laborious side, isn't there? Because for the designer, coming up with the concept and having moves, and then physically having to do all those technical drawings is a rather laborious thing, I would have thought.
It's not laborious for me because I don't do it, because I can't draw on the computer. And I've never been interested in doing that.
I wanted to ask you about that very thing, actually, because obviously just as in all creative fields, the advent of the computer and CAD and all those things has had an enormous, you know, change on how things are done.
Yeah.
Everything was analog, you know, drawn by hand. But now, in films particularly, I mean, Stuart Craig was saying, you know, something like 80% now of the Harry Potter films are CGI.
Yeah.
You know, and he has to design and sit with these, you know, highly creative people who are just really just fantastic technicians.
Yeah.
He himself still loves build. You know, he wants to stand in that set and not in a blue or black or green screen, which is... And I'm wondering how much... I mean, obviously, the theatre, that hasn't affected the theatre. Maybe it has in doing technical drawings, but the theatre is still a built space.
It is. I think the only thing that has changed quite recently is the improved use of video.
Yes.
I used to avoid video mad because it just had a quality which I hated. But now it's so sophisticated, and there are some video designers who are so good. Mm. I've worked with several recently, particularly on dance pieces.
So
work they do is just magical.
I mean, do you envisage seeing a background set being projected digitally that is of such quality that you could almost give the illusion that you're looking down a long, you know, I'm just thinking, because you're quite right, that the early days of, you know, back projection and digital projection was awful. It was all slightly blurred and, you know, had lots of horizontal light. It really crude and awful, but now they are just getting so good.
Yeah, and similarly, actually, computer painting or draw... you know, you can have a backcloth painted by a computer.
And have it digitally run
out. You know, now they're pretty terrific. The early days, they were awful. But I don't think, I mean, in my mind, to my aesthetic, nothing will ever replace something that's hand-painted.
Well, that's what photographers said about film.
That's true.
And they still hang in, a lot of them still hang in there, but most of the photographers I know that were the diehards, you know, when you bump into them and you say, how are you doing? And they say, oh, digital's got so much better now and it's so convenient and all the clients want it.
Yeah.
It slowly creeps in there. And it's rather like letterpress printing. It's a sort of an artisan craft thing now, whereas it was an everyday thing,
yeah,
you know, back in the 50s, right up till, you know, the mid to late 60s. Letterpress was a normal process. All our newspapers were letterpress. It creeps in.
My costume drawings, for instance, I still insist on drawing everyone myself. There's some there that on a piece of watercolour paper.
Well, that's
great. And they're drawn in pencil, and then I paint them in gouache and watercolour.
Oh, well, that's great.
And I'll never stop doing that.
No, so you're not using the iPad to do them, like David Hockney. I mean, who I have to say has mastered.
Oh, fantastic.
You know, did you see the exhibition?
I mean,
I was astonished at how good that can be. And as he said, one time the pencil was a piece of new technology.
Yeah.
So he's always embraced that. Drawing is one of those things that over the years, so many people said, you know, they don't draw in colleges anymore. They should draw. But there is a big resurgence now. You know, kids are drawing all the time. I think it's great.
It is great.
I mean, I don't know if you agree, but it seems to me that the moment there's the technology of the day becomes the norm, the younger, you know, students all hark back to a nostalgia for something that they never actually lived through. So they want everything sort of, you know, they want to go back to vinyl and all these sort of things. You know,
that's true.
Because they kind of they're trendy to them. It's quite interesting. So the digital world has really not had a big impact on you, apart from the ease of doing drawings, which you don't use computer yourself for that sort. You just use it for emails and that sort of stuff.
Research.
If you're working on 4 productions a year, and traveling a lot, which you clearly do, how do you relax? I mean, what do you do? How do you differentiate between work and home life, for example? Or do you not differentiate? Are they one and the same thing?
No, I do differentiate. I love reading. I read an enormous amount. I love cooking. I like going to, things like going to exhibitions and things. I mean, I suppose they're partly work, in that quite often it can be sort of research related or something like that, but I found it very relaxing going to museums and exhibitions.
And do you go to many productions other than...
Not as many as I used to. I used to sort of try and go and see everything, especially when I was a student in the sort of early days. I used to see buy the cheapest tickets or try and get into the dress rehearsal or a preview or something and saw everything. Now I'm much more picky. I'd only go and see something if I'm pretty much convinced I'm going to love it.
Yes.
I think it's important when you're young to go and see everything, because you learn just as much from seeing something dreadful as you do something good. Whereas the older you get and the more experienced you are, that's no longer the case. I mean, there's absolutely no point in going to see something that might be terrible.
So you're currently, the project you're currently working on is the Ring Cycle.
Yeah.
Which is going to happen in Italy?
In Palermo, at the Teatro Massimo, which is the biggest theatre in Italy, bigger than La Scala. And with the recession and Sicily and all that, we don't have a huge budget. So what I've designed is, of necessity, quite simple.
Right.
And also because the stage is so big, you know, just filling that stage costs a fortune. So I think it's going to be a fun project, actually. I hope.
And that's due to open in the middle of next year or late next year?
No, the first one opens at the end of January, Rheingold, and then Valcura at the end of February.
So have you designed it yet?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you have?
Yes.
Okay.
No, they've had
I didn't say,
all.
Yes.
Yeah, they've
yes,
had
they've
the
done
design
all of that.
Since July. No, I'm now going there to actually, rehearsals are starting and we'll put it on the stage.
Now, I'm looking at your many awards. I was looking for the mantelpiece, actually, because I thought it must be a pretty big mantelpiece. But you've got the Laurence Olivier Award for your Old Vic season back in the late 80s.
That was my real big break. Jonathan Miller asking me to do 7 plays in a row at the Old Vic was the most incredible thing.
And how did you find working with Jonathan Miller?
Fascinating.
He was...
He was just so inspiring, you know, he's so knowledgeable.
He's a total polymath, I mean...
Total polymath, and he just taught me so much and introduced me to all sorts of things, you know, painters and photographers and buildings and things that I knew nothing about.
Yes, he's one of those...
It's inspiring. You
totally.
Know, we'd be sitting in my studio trying to resolve the problem of designing something obscure like Bussy d'Amboise, and then suddenly Jonathan would say, "Hang on, let's go in the car. I've got something to show you. There's an old shop that closed down years ago in Bermondsey. I think you'll like the window." And so we jump in the car and we drive over there. And sure enough, you know, there'd be this filthy window covered in dust with a sort of broken bit of curtain behind it and, you know, a sign saying closed or something. And we'd take photographs of it. And then that would be the beginning of an idea for a set.
Amazing. He also, I remember seeing a program that he makes his own sculptural pieces from
yes.
found objects, which
yes.
he, you know, he doesn't give a damn. He says, I don't care who likes them or not. I love them. I love doing
yeah.
them. And they're rather good.
They're beautiful.
Really,
yeah.
very good. He,
yeah.
he is an amazing, I mean, you know, when you use the word, or when they use the word national treasure, he really is, because he's been around, he's funny. You know, I remember once he designed a book cover, which is, you know, used to be my territory, and it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And it's very annoying. So I'm wondering why he... Has he designed sets himself?
He has, on one or two occasions. No, I really... I think I owe my career to him. I mean, his generosity in giving me that enormous job
yes.
and that big responsibility. I was relatively inexperienced
yeah.
then. Nobody would do that now. Nobody would take that risk. What if I'd cocked up?
Yeah. I mean, well, did they? I mean, you actually did sort of have them back to back.
Back to back.
Yeah. So
I had the most
once
brilliant.
You start,
yeah.
Yes.
Working with the same team.
Yeah.
You know, the same costume supervisor, the same wig and hair designer, and
yeah.
the same lighting designer. We just had a ball for a year
well,
and a half.
Well, it paid
really.
Off because you know, obviously the Laurence Olivier Awards recognised that. And obviously you have a Tony for The Lion King and Critics Circle. Ovations Award and the Hollywood NAACP Award, and you've got honorary doctorates and fellowships and your Royal Design and Fringes. So what do you think is your greatest achievement?
Oh, that's really difficult to answer. I mean, I know that The Lion King will be etched on my gravestone.
I'm sure it will.
And in a funny way, I suppose that is my greatest achievement.
Yeah.
I mean, as I said, 65 million people have seen it.
Yeah.
You know, and a large percentage of those are children. And I know that, you know, if I had seen something like The Lion King when I was 6 or 7,
yes.
I would have thought I'd died,
yes.
gone to heaven. And I'm deeply touched when I go to places like Tokyo, where I went a few years ago to give some lectures about my work. I was invited by the Japanese Society of Stage Designers. And after these lectures, I was sort of mobbed. I would dare to say, almost like a pop star, by mainly girls who had seen The Lion King and would tell me that it had changed their lives. I remember meeting one girl who said that she worked in a makeup department in a department store, and she saw The Lion King, and she gave up her job and decided she was going to be a stage
really?
Designer as a result of
well,
seeing
that's
that
terrific.
Show.
The idea of exciting, you know, young kids into the world of theatre has got to be a great thing,
yeah.
you know, when you consider all the horrors that are going on in the world.
Yeah.
I mean,
or on television.
Television,
or, you know.
All those things. It's a great thing. So, thinking about, you just mentioned the young girl that decided to give up her job and try to get into theatre. What advice would you give to any young aspiring designers now, starting now, at Wimbledon maybe, you know,
yeah.
just thinking about the future, what are the key things that you think you could pass on to them?
Oh, that's difficult to answer because I think the world has changed so much since I was a student. I think there are so many courses now churning out God knows how many aspiring stage designers. In my day, there were far fewer of us. And also, I think I was just really fortunate. I mean, my first few jobs and sort of big breaks, I literally sort of fell into them by accident. And I wonder if that kind of luck is still around, you know, those sort of opportunities. Funnily enough, I have two goddaughters who are both in their early 20s, and both of them want to be stage designers. One of them is at Wimbledon School of Art, and the other is at the Bristol Old Vic School. So... it's in the next year or so, they're going to be asking my advice about, you know, well, what do we do now?
Well, they're very lucky to have you around.
Back to something I said earlier, actually. I think it's really important to see lots of theatre
yes.
when you're that young
yeah.
and when you're starting out. Not just seeing things, but also being seen.
Mm.
I was thinking about it the other day, actually. I'm amazed at the number of times I've been asked to do a project in a theatre because a director or a choreographer has spotted me in the audience and suddenly gone, oh,
really?
Richard, would you like to do...
So being seen.
Being seen.
And being around is an important thing, rather than being a shrinking violet and staying in your garret.
Yes.
Yeah. No,
no, I can see it. You've got to get out there.
Yes. I'm sure that your ring cycle will be received very well next year. I'm sure it'll be very exciting to do that. Richard Hudson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you.